Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV. Today we're talking with David Stockman, a former congressman who is best remembered as the budget director for Ronald Reagan. David, thanks for talking with us.
Good to be here.
You're back in the spotlight and getting roasted again by your fellow Republicans because you've been an outspoken advocate of letting all of the Bush-era tax rates expire. What's your rationale behind that?
Well, in pure philosophy, lower tax rates would be better. The problem is we've had a 30-year referendum on spending, every aspect of the welfare state. We made a tiny bit of progress in 81. That was restored over the course of the next couple of decades. Then we finally had Republican government in the Bush era, both in the Congress and in the White House, and nothing was cut.
Right.
Everything was ratified. In fact, they added to Medicare through the drug benefit.
Right.
And
yeah,
education.
And in fact,
so now
Bush
we're at a point.
Bush raised the total federal outlays about 60% in 2010 dollars.
That's exactly right. So now we're at the point where we have this large welfare state that seems immovable politically, and this expanding warfare state that both parties seem to want to fund. And in that environment, you're kidding yourself if you think cutting taxes today is really cutting taxes. We're simply deferring massive tax increases into the future, unfairly and immorally putting huge debt burdens on future generations. And that is just wrong.
There's a presumption there that if we raised more federal revenue, that would go to pay what we're actually doing now, as opposed to just give the government more impetus to grow even faster.
Well, that's always a risk, but I think the fact is there isn't much pressure for structural expansion of the budget right now.
Does there need to be, though? Because, I mean, Medicare spending is set to continue to expand, particularly after 2020. I mean, so there doesn't need to be a politician saying, let's create whole new entitlements, because we've got ones that are on autopilot to explode, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, the cost trajectory of the entitlements and the program structure that is there will rise over time. And part of the fiscal battle will be to find ways to contain that. So I very strongly believe that in addition to allowing the tax cuts to expire, we need to means test radically the retirement entitlements.
In the past few years, we've seen under Bush and then continued under President Obama, things like TARP, things like stimulus spending. I mean, it started under Bush in 2008, was obviously kicked into high gear by Obama. Are we in a place now where bailouts will become a constant part of American life?
Well, that is a pressure and that is a clear risk. I believe in some ways it was a profound moment in political history in September 2008 when Paulson panicked. Mm-hmm. And of course, Bush was a deer in a headlight. He had no clue about what was going on and stampeded the Republicans into enacting TARP.
Why was TARP a bad idea? I mean, we have President Bush, we have President Obama, we have Tim Geithner, we have a bunch of Nobel Prize-winning economists telling us, we have Warren Buffett saying, TARP, you know, that's the only reason you and I are still talking, it's the only reason why there's still lights on.
Well, first of all, that's urban mythology. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was panic on Main Street in America. What was happening was that the big pyramids of debt on Wall Street were coming crashing down, and had we allowed nature to take its course, maybe the Goldman Sachs stock would have gone down to $10,
right.
But that's their problem, and that's the problem of speculators who own the stock, not a problem, systematic problem for the economy. Maybe a couple of banks would have been closed by the FDIC, and whether you believe in deposit insurance or not, which I don't, it was there, and that was the function of deposit insurance.
So what happened then? Why did that win the political battle?
Because Paulson, frankly, is the most incompetent, reckless Secretary of the Treasury we've had in modern history, if ever. And he had no schooling in public policy. He had no schooling in the longer term issues of fiscal management or even, what sound money is all about, for crying out loud. And as a result, as the crisis metastasized in September, October of 2008, and he got all these panic calls from his buddies on Wall Street who were seeing their pyramids of debt come crashing down, and particularly when the stock of Goldman Sachs started to plunge, He panicked. There was no philosophy behind it. There was never an analysis done. This whole idea that there was systemic risk, it's just a term made up by people who were looking for ways to meddle in the economy.
Do you
and,
think that
he ran with it?
Should the Feds have, the Fed or any portion of the federal government, should they have bailed out Bear Stearns? Should they have bailed out Lehman Brothers? Should they have bailed out Goldman Sachs? Should they have bailed out GM? Do bailouts at any point make sense?
No, I think absolutely not. Once the broad public sees that the cronies of capitalism are bailed out by their friends in Washington or the Fed, why should they believe that the system we have is fair or is working in their interest?
Isn't this the oldest story of American capitalism, which is that there is always at some point there is somebody who's too big to fail, or more correctly, too politically connected to fail?
Well, I think the risk has always been there, but historically there was, at least in the Republican Party, principled beliefs that the marketplace had to be allowed to operate and that both gains and losses would occur. And even though there was pressure from time to time for interventions and bailouts, it was pretty rare, if at all. During the Eisenhower administration, for instance, even though Ike was suspected of not being a good conservative,
suspected of being a communist by the Birch
If you look at the economic policy of the Eisenhower era, it was pretty solid. He actually believed in balancing the budget and balanced the budget three times. During the Ford era, again, President Ford was pretty much a free enterprise believer, and there aren't too many examples that you could come up with where there was outright bailouts. But I think the problem really gathered momentum in the late 70s after inflation got out of control because we closed the gold window in 1971. Then politicians began to find reasons for expediency. The Chrysler bailout was a terrible thing.
Even though it kept the company alive, it's still
with us. Well, kept the company alive long enough so that it could die again and take GM down with it and cause a second bailout.
Right.
In the Reagan era, I thought we were free enterprise, and mostly we were, but we bailed out Continental Bank against the strong belief of myself and many others in the administration, but it was kind of forced through panic.
What do you do with the savings
and loan?
What do you do with savings and loan? Was that systemic risk when the savings and loan industry collapsed?
Well, first of all, the problem that blew up in the late 80s was encouraged by bad mistakes made by the Reagan administration in the early 80s. We deregulated the S&Ls and allowed them to speculate in all kinds of real estate and land development and so forth.
Which, se, is not a problem, right?
It's a problem if they have guaranteed deposit insurance, and if they have federal entities to turn to bail them out if they make reckless mistakes. Well, all of them did. And so we ended up with insolvent institutions in mass in the late 80s, and I think they did more or less a reasonable job of dealing with that because all of them were closed and liquidated, and losses were absorbed by the equity speculators and the, you know, junior bond speculators in these failed S&Ls. The depositors were protected because that's what the deposit insurance system is. But it was a good lesson that we had danger built into the heart of our banking system because of deposit insurance, which allowed speculators to raise money without people worrying about the risk of investing. And they had access to the Fed window, which says that if you really go off the edge of the cliff and become illiquid because you're investing long and funding short, which is foolish and has always been frowned upon by sound banking theory historically, we should have seen it coming. In other words, the S&L crisis was a wake-up call that deposit insurance and the Fed were about ready to fuel a far greater banking system bubble and blow up. And sure enough, 15 years later, that's exactly what we had. And then when the crisis came, we went in and bailed out the whole thing again and have just created the condition for even more traumatic excess in the future.
Now, but we've solved all our problems, right, with the Dodd-Frank financial regulation bill, you know, which is being touted certainly by the Obama administration and I guess by Chris Dodd and Barney Frank as, you know, the be-all and end-all. Does that change anything? Does it address any of the issues that you're talking about, and does it make you sleep easier at night knowing that we're now regulated in a different way?
Well, really not at all, because it's just another sort of crony capitalist shuffle. If we really have a problem in our banking system of too big to fail, which I profoundly believe we do, then the institutions involved are too big to exist. And by that, I mean exist with access to the Federal Deposit Insurance guarantees and therefore the ability to raise hundreds of billions or trillions of deposits, and with access to the Fed window. So what happened? At the end of 2007, before the crisis actually hit fully, the top four banks in this country had $5 trillion of asset footings combined. After the whole crisis of too big to fail and all of the bailouts and putting the taxpayer in harm's way in a manner never done before, today, the top four banks have $7 trillion of asset footings. So what we did and what the FDIC and the Federal Reserve did in their wisdom was to actually just steepen and enlarge the problem. So I believe in narrow banking. I believe that if you're going to have deposit insurance, it should be for banks that can lend for only short periods of time for commercial activities where the risk of loss is minimal. And if you want to be in the speculation business, if you want to be in the over-the-counter derivatives marketing business, if you want to make long-term loans in speculative real estate and even business enterprises, fine. Be my guest, do it as a free enterprise financial institution. But don't look for guaranteed deposits to raise your funding, and don't think you should have access to the Fed window in case you make a discount window, that is, in the event that you make large mistakes. That is the fundamental line of demarcation that needs to be addressed, and the legislation passed by Congress, the so-called FinReg, doesn't do any of that. It simply involves 2,300 pages of Enabling Act, which empowers the same institutions who fostered this crisis, the Fed, the FDIC, the controller, to determine what those mean. And it more or less is a full employment act for lobbyists, lawyers, accounting consultants, and so forth to find ways to build loopholes, which is easy enough to do.
Now, in the New York Times over the summer, you laid one of the four deformations of the fiscal apocalypse on the heads of pointless speculation in stocks, bonds, commodities, and derivatives. Are you arguing that essentially that this trade only existed because of regulations or of a government system or a political economy where people knew if they were playing around with that kind of stuff that they would get bailed out?
Well, I think it goes beyond or further back than that. I think it goes to the closing of the gold window in 1971. It goes to the destruction.
And that because the last shred of anchoring the U.S. dollar to a gold standard.
Yes, and because that system, as it had its defects, Bretton Woods. But at the heart of it was a fixed exchange rate system and an obligation on each company and country, including the United States, to settle its accounts at the end of every year. And if you began to run chronic payments deficits, you were going to, under that system, lose your monetary reserves. Gold, if you were the United States, or dollar reserve assets, if you were other participants in the system. And what that did was foster continuous financial discipline. Because any country losing large-scale reserves would find its banking system contracting, interest rates rising, its economy slowing down, and the basis for a sustainable adjustment to occur. Now, when we got rid of all of that and went to pure fiat money, it began a process in which financial volatility and instability reached what had been previously unimaginable levels. And so if you have exchange rates careening all over the place, if you have interest rates soaring and then declining and then bouncing to and fro, the market will invent hedges, which is to say currency futures and hedges of every kind, interest rate hedges of every imaginable kind, in order to meet the need of participants in the system to have some certainty about the value value of things. Mm-hmm. So I think much of this massive, you know, 700 trillion derivatives market, which is out there, was fostered by the breakdown of fixed exchange rates and the anchor of the monetary system to an asset, gold in that case, that couldn't be manipulated for short-term purposes by governments and central banks. Once these things were invented because of the turbulence in the market for legitimate hedging, there was nothing to stop all the casino players from jumping in and simply speculating.
You know, this is probably a good time to bring up some of your Austrian friends, Austrian economists. You know, on the one hand, you would have somebody like Murray Rothbard, who believed in, I guess, free banking, but also a gold standard. Then you had somebody like Friedrich Hayek, who talked about competing currencies. And, you know, with the breakdown of the gold standard, the breakdown of Bretton Woods, don't we effectively have what Hayek would consider a market in competing currencies? Different countries, or something like the EU, to the extent that their money isn't sound, investors will devalue it, and they'll move. You know, the market will respond to that. Why is that not working in a way that Bretton Woods might have at some point to kind of keep people from just running up or printing out cheap money?
Well, I think because mainly the system that he imagined, if I understand it correctly, was privately issued currencies. Mm-hmm. What we have is currency issued by the sovereign, the United States, in unlimited quantities in the context of a global system where all the other central banks are lined up in some kind of caravan trying to mimic the policies of the Fed, mostly defensively. When we flood the world with dollars, if the Fed does, they have to buy them up and print their own currency in order to prevent their exchange rate from going up. So when this is a government-issued currency, I think you get the exact mess that we have today. Ultimately, what really is the issue is the need for periodic settlement of accounts, financial discipline. And once we got rid of that, what happened was something Milton Friedman said could never happen. Mm-hmm. He said, don't worry about the balance of payments crisis under Bretton Woods. Essentially, close the gold window, let the dollar float, and the world currency market will take care of trade imbalances. He was totally wrong. We've had $8 trillion worth of cumulative current account deficits with the rest of the world since the late 1970s, year after year.
What is the real effect of that, though? Because some people would say, well, you know what that means is that we're getting more for our money.
No, the real effect of it is that we're living way beyond our means. We're building up service obligations to the holders of all that paper. I mean, when you run a current account, it's the same thing as borrowing from the rest of the world. The Chinese own well over $1 trillion of claims on the United States and the Japanese and the OPEC producers and on you could go. So the idea that we're getting something for free is makes no sense to me. And second, you're encouraging the mercantilist, you know, export model of East Asia to become even more virulently destructive than it actually is, because they somehow believe they can export their way to permanent prosperity, and if they have to build up massive dollar reserves of greater and greater and greater magnitude, which is exactly what they're doing, They seem to think that will work. Obviously, in the long run, it won't. Japan is already proof of that. But it leads to these kinds of massive imbalances and distortions in international trade and monetary system that I believe are on the verge of major conflagration the whole thing heats up.
Let's talk a little bit about your kind of political philosophy and economic philosophy. You went to Michigan State. You were a congressman from Michigan before you became budget director. You've written fondly of people like Hayek and Murray Rothbard, Mises, not so hot on Friedman or certainly the Keynesians. Where did these ideas come from? When did you get interested in economics? And how do you define yourself in economic terms?
Well, I think the thing you left out is that, yes, I grew up in Michigan, but I was an anti-war radical as a student at Michigan State. So I guess in the heat of, total nonsense of the Vietnam War, I developed a skepticism of the warfare state and of the military and of a adventurist
Were you
policy.
Always a Republican?
No, I was a SDS quasi-Marxist radical. Then, as I went to Capitol Hill as a staffer, I began to see the virtues of what I would call the libertarian view, which isn't that far from, in some ways, the radical left that we looked at, that I felt I believed in as
Talk
a student.
Talk about what's the common thread?
Well, I think the common thread is that, you know, individual action and freedom and liberty to pursue both economic or other ends is the core of what society should be built on. And so I became very interested in free market economics as a staffer on Capitol Hill. Then I was elected to Congress, pursued that
Talk
further.
Talk a little bit about who were you a staffer for and then how, you know, to say, and then I was elected to Congress as if, you know, you were walking down the street and got hit, you know, by something falling out of a window. What went into those determinations?
Well, I was a staffer for Congressman John Anderson, who was chairman of the Republican caucus, considered a moderate, but actually he was the right kind of Republican in my view, because he was a social liberal and an economic conservative. And the work I did was a lot of things on deregulating transportation, let's say, the minimum wage being counterproductive, the need to reorganize or eliminate the whole Great Society set of programs that had developed and so forth. On the other hand, he, as a moderate on social issues, didn't believe the government ought to be intervening in our private lives. And I agree with that. I agreed with that then, and I still do now. So it was out of that period that I more fully formed my philosophy. I ran for Congress then and was elected in 1976 and had a chance to begin to develop those ideas legislatively, maybe culminating in two battles that I fought, three really, before I went into the Reagan White House. One was deregulation of natural gas, but that was the leading edge of the whole fight with Carterite statist energy policy. I was on the Energy Committee and was one of the leaders of the fight for deregulating natural gas, but opposing all the other Carter nonsense like Sin Fuels Corporation and regulatory standards for the energy efficiency of toasters and so forth. So I began to see there the danger of statist industrial policy or economic policy, and had some good experience fighting it.
And it's peculiar, too, that, I mean, Carter was really very good at deregulating, because he also deregulated interstate trucking, railroads, and airplanes, but then was just a statist in other, in kind of fanciful dreams that he had,
Yeah, well, I think it depended on the advisors. He had some advisors who could see the insanity of the CAB, Civil Aeronautics Board, or the ICC trying to set tens of thousands of rail tariffs and so forth, trucking tariffs. But then in the energy side, because again of short-run panic about what was going on with OPEC and the oil price, which really was a function of inflationary monetary policy. But the bad monetary policy led to a perception that there was something wrong in the energy economy, which generated, Professor Schlesinger and all his minions running around trying to create a state-run energy sector. So I fought that, and I learned a lot about the danger. Then, shortly after that, came the Chrysler bailout.
Right.
And I was from Michigan.
Yeah.
There were a lot of Chrysler suppliers in my district, but I strongly opposed it, gave a loud speech on the floor about it, found that Lee Iacocca was about ready to run me out of the state on a rail, or wished he could have.
Right.
But, you know, the
thing
is...
Well, he couldn't have used a Chrysler, that's for sure, right?
But the thing is, I was right, not only that, but in the next election, I got the largest vote I'd ever received.
So what does that say about political economy, though? Because, I mean, there you are in Michigan, and you're running against one of the fair-haired boys, one of the major employers in the state, and saying, like, no, they should live or die in the market. And it didn't hurt you politically?
Because the rank and file of businessmen in my district, little machine tool shops, or someone running a plant where they mixed fertilizers, let's say, and distributed to farmers.
What area were you?
Southwestern Michigan.
Okay.
And it was kind of half ag, half industrial, knew that they weren't too big to fail.
Right.
That if they were ever up against the wall, their creditors would put them into Chapter 11, and that's the way the system worked. So I had overwhelming support, except for the few squeaky wheels, a couple half dozen suppliers who sold parts to Chrysler. And I think the problem we have in our political system is that enough politicians are not willing to think that through. They hear the squeaky wheel and they respond. And they really don't have to. I also was a liberal on social issues, voted against, the Hyde Amendment, anti-abortion amendment, 110 times. And my district was very conservative, but they respected my opinion. So I think the idea that you just have to kowtow to all the pressure groups and all the squeaky wheels is not really necessary, but now, 30 years later, is probably unavoidable, because money has become such a massive force in the electoral process.
Okay, so you go from being in Congress to becoming Reagan's budget director. And, you know, among other things, what that produced was your memoir, The Triumph of Politics.
Right.
But talk a little bit about what you came into the Reagan administration, and you believed the hype, right, that he was going to cut taxes and he was going to cut spending. He was going to cut the size and scope of government, of the federal government. And you went, you worked long and hard on coming up with the way to cut taxes, right?
Right.
And that was successful. Give for people who don't remember really high marginal tax rates in the U.S., what did you cut? What did Reagan cut the top tax rates from?
All right. The top tax rate on earned income was 50% at the time, and I think we ended up in the low 40s. But it was about a 30% cut. The thing I learned out of that tax cutting exercise was twofold. One is that, and this is still not focused on, there wasn't much popular support for across-the-board rate reductions that would benefit the average citizen or even entrepreneur businessman. Mm-hmm. The only way that we got that through, despite all the urban legend that exists today, was through a massive Christmas tree of special interest tax benefits and loopholes that were appended to it. The numbers are simple. The revenue reduction was $1 trillion over 5 years from the tax cut. Half of it, $500 billion, was for the rate reduction. The other half was for oil depletion incentives, real estate tax breaks.
So in other words, you're giving back half of that through goodies.
Yeah, and so we ended up reducing the revenue far beyond what was feasible, even if there had been a determination to really cut spending. Mm-hmm. But what happened subsequently was almost no spending was cut.
Right.
And the defense budget soared out of control. We knew going in that there was a commitment by President Reagan to rebuild defense capability. But what happened in the early days was that the Pentagon distorted campaign promises for real growth of 5%, which they then raised to 7%, and Reagan went along. And then they started it from a much higher base which is to say a supplemental bill.
So
and as a result of that, defense spending got totally out of control,
right. even though discretionary, non-defense discretionary spending was coming down.
A little bit. It did come down.
Not all that much.
But we cut very little out of the entitlements other than some things that were appropriate and have survived, food stamp reform and AFDC. Mm-hmm. But the middle class entitlements weren't cut. The whole complex of veterans programs weren't cut. Mm-hmm. Agricultural subsidies were not seriously mm-hmm. tampered with. And so as a result of that, we may have gotten a few tens of billions mm-hmm. annually of savings, but over time, most of that crept back into
the
system.
Reagan was famous for, of course, saying that government wasn't the solution to the problem, government was the problem. Why wasn't he more skeptical of Pentagon claims of what they needed and of where their financial estimates were coming from?
That's one of the, I guess, maybe mysteries of the time, and it's one of the factors that led to the utter failure of spending control. He mm-hmm. utterly uninterested in any detail of the defense budget, of any of the claims for dollars made by the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. He gave them a blank check without question, and that had a twofold effect. One, it ballooned spending just as we were massively reducing the revenue. But second, it created an enormous political impasse. Mm-hmm. And that is that the spending increases were so huge in defense that it became almost impossible to get anybody to look at you with a straight face on Capitol Hill and say, we're going to go after the food stamp program, or we're going to go after women's infants and children feeding program, or school lunches, when you're just showering tens of billions of dollars on, you know, ammunition accounts and spare parts mm-hmm. replacements and a massive expansion of the Navy, which was totally uncalled for.
Well, here's a question, though. At least we won the Cold War. Was the defense buildup, was it necessary in your mind to us actually winning the Cold War?
I don't know. Someone said that the SDI, the Star mm-hmm. Wars, was never a program. It was a speech.
Right.
But the speech was enough to make Gorbachev realize that it was game over. But my view is that communism never worked. The Soviet Union was a house of cards from day one in 1917. It was only a matter of time, if we had mm-hmm. really believed our free enterprise principles and our understanding mm-hmm. of a free society and capitalism, we would have realized in 1980 that the Soviet Empire was going to collapse mm-hmm. sooner or later on its own weight, and we didn't need to try to spend it into mm-hmm. Collapse. Because it was already happening. So I don't buy the idea that this huge Reagan buildup, mm-hmm. defense buildup, was what allowed us to win the Cold War. Someone said that in the 1980s we were in a race with the Soviet Union to see who could reach bankruptcy first.
Yeah.
They won by a hair, but it's not really the defense budget that did it.
Between 81 and 85, basically the Reagan administration doubled the national debt. You left office, or you left the White House in 85. By 88, it had gone up about 2.5 times. What would you have done differently, knowing how things played out, if you were starting again as budget director in 1981?
Well, I think you would really have to sit down and make some very large and honest conclusions. And that is, how much defense do we really want? Let's mm-hmm. lay it out. Let's justify it. Let's analyze the trade-offs and so forth. That's one big piece of the state. Then what is the welfare state that we're going to keep because we don't have the political will to change mm-hmm. it, or we believe it is mm-hmm. necessary? And if that's 24% of GDP or 20% mm-hmm. of GDP, then what is the optimum tax system that will raise 20% mm-hmm. or 24% as the case may be? And therefore, if we need to lower income taxes, which I believed at the time and still mm-hmm. do for incentive purposes or because of bracket creep, mm-hmm. then what alternative revenue mechanism, such as a value-added tax mm-hmm. or some other consumption-oriented tax do we need to put in place to fund the government we've concluded
Need? Have we had, two things come to my mind on that. Why don't we have those conversations about defense, say, where you were saying earlier, I mean, one of, you know, Obama won election partly as an anti-war candidate, and he is certainly, I mean, he's disappointed, I think, everybody, maybe one of his daughters still believes in him, but you know, clearly he's a war president, and he seems to be relishing that role. But you know, have we had an argument about what is the proper role of defense? Defense spending has gone up tremendously in the past 10 years. You know, why don't we have those conversations?
Well, you know, I think it's partly the way the whole political debate and ideology has evolved. I'll simply point out the last honest war president we had was Truman, surprisingly. And when the Vietnam or the Korean War budget ballooned, he demanded the Congress institute major tax increases, excise taxes, income taxes, to pay for the war on a pay-as-you-go basis. Now, I'm not sure we ever accomplished anything useful in the Korean War in the light of history. But he was right at the time if you were going to do this. We always should have had the principle that if you're going to have a Vietnam War or a Gulf War I or a Iraqi invasion, then attach it to war finance, to the taxes needed. And one, I think you'll get a better decision.
Right.
People will ask, do we want to spend $100 billion on wars of occupation in places that are the ends of the earth and not strategically important?
If not because of an explicit conversation, but because of historical reality, since 1950, federal revenues have averaged about 18% of GDP. That seems to be the amount of money at any point that we're willing to shell out in a given year. And it goes up or down a little bit, but it's never been higher than about 20.6% of GDP, and it's at one of its relative lows this year, partly because of the recession. But, you know, why is it impossible to say, okay, we're going to peg our spending, our total outlays in any given year to 18% or 19% if we have that conversation? I mean, is the triumph of politics that we don't even get to have those conversations, or that we'll have them, but then we don't really stick ourselves to it, we don't keep to a budget?
Well, first, I think we need to have the conversations, but then we need to recognize the underlying demographic context of what the steady state claim on GDP is. And the whole entitlement structure, retirement entitlement, Social Security, Medicare, it's an intergenerational Ponzi scheme. The baby boom is now inexorably moving towards retirement and beyond. And so, therefore, the share of GDP that it's consuming continues to rise. And if we take that and add all of the other traditional functions of government, the slight additions we've made to things like education, which are a bit out of control, and then a high level of defense spending, which we have but don't really need, in my view, in this world, you're in the 22 to 25% range. Right. And I don't see any way of getting out of that.
Isn't there a way I can say you're at the leading edge of the baby boom, right?
Right.
Yeah, I'm at the back end, and I can tell you that nothing would please me more than to see you and all of your cohort go off in an iceberg somewhere. You know, part of this, and it goes back to your experience in the Reagan White House. Reagan was very much a child of the Great Depression and of World War II, and of an era in America of real privation. By the time you came along, and by the time I came along, we were in the baby boom. It's a radically different world. I mean, you are not growing old in your parents' world, in your parents' America. You know, you're not talking about even in the mid-60s where seniors had a much higher than average poverty rate. Now they're far below the average poverty rate. Isn't it time that we restrike this intergenerational entitlement? I mean, because that is the problem. I mean, Medicare, Social Security, not even so much Medicaid. I mean, isn't it time to have that conversation and say the social bargain that governed America from about 1935 until about 1995 no longer applies?
Yeah, I think that conversation will happen, but
Is that to talk about, I mean, reasons for hope or thin reeds for hope, Is that what the Tea Party is about?
Well, maybe there's a tiny glimpse that the conversation is starting. I don't think the Tea Party is really that coherent. It is simply, I think, more a reaction to the economic turmoil that's occurred and the fear that's been generated in Main Street and the appropriate antipathy that's developed towards the crony capitalist policy of bailing out anybody who's big and strong like GM and Goldman Sachs and so forth. But beyond that, I don't think the conversation has really started, although the facts are that the current generation of workers are going to be turned into tax slaves, just like the workers in Ireland today are finding out that they are. And that will have to change, but it'll only change when the crisis comes. It's going to be a very bad hair day, but it's unavoidable.
Do you, I mean, do you see anybody in the political arena who is, you know, who gives you hope or who seems to get what you're talking about?
On that, I think the heart of the problem is our monetary system is out of control. Our money printing is destroying and distorting and contorting our economy. It's leading everything to a kind of casinos, speculative system, not a sustainable productivity-based growth system. There's only one guy who understands it. It's Ron Paul.
Right. Well,
there's no one else who understands it.
He's newly ascendant in terms of power, right?
That's true.
And, I mean, so do you think that that will be the beginning, or could that be the beginning?
Well, I think maybe it'll begin to disinfect the process. Maybe it'll begin to shed some light on all the pretensions and the scholastic arrogance of the Fed, Fed's economist and the Federal Reserve itself, and that maybe is at least a small step towards beginning to address the real problems in this country.
Well, David Stockman, thank you very much for a really interesting conversation.
Thank you.